Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Principle of Hospitality, the podcast. Now, we've had a collision of worlds, a joining of forces, a banding of brothers. Sash from Principle Design and me, Sean from Open Pantry Consulting, are pleased to announce this venture for 2021, Principle of Hospitality. Now, we know that food brings people together and promotes community. And at Principle of Hospitality, we are here to disrupt current perceptions of what the hospitality industry can achieve in today's ever-evolving and challenging environment. Now, that's why we've partnered with Chef's Hat on this Principle of Hospitality podcast. Now, if you didn't know, Chef's Hat is the largest family-owned and operated hospitality supplier in Australia. They strive to inspire cooks, chefs, bakers, and bartenders to deliver the best product with the best tools every day. So that's why we're so proud to partner with Chef's Hat, where the industry shops. Now let's get into today's podcast. I think you're really gonna enjoy it. Welcome to the Principle of Hospitality podcast. It's fantastic to have you listening along, so thanks for tuning in. Ferguson Player is a fifth generation family bakery business with over 119 years of retail baking pedigree. And you know how much I really care about bakery, so I'm excited for this podcast today. But they don't just care about amazing bakery products. In fact, they also have done a collaboration with Sustainability Victoria, in which they launched the first hybrid truck to hit Victorian streets. The brand's sustainable practices have also received a number of awards as well, which they have over 80 stores, I should say, across Victoria, with more on the way soon. It's a real true Australian success story. So it's a privilege to sit down with the passionate CEO, Steve Player. Hey, Steve, how are you?
Yeah, g'day, Sean. How are you doing? Thanks for having us.
It is fantastic to have you on the podcast and to really, you know, build a friendship the last couple of months and understand more about your brand. I want to talk about, obviously, the YouTube and TikTok sensation of last year, but more from that, I want to talk about this brand and how, you know, obviously it entitles your name as well. So I want to talk about that. But how did you start out in the industry?
Yeah, well, I mean, both my brother and I have been family business, born into it. Is the short answer. you know, love a cake, love a pie. That's what Dad did. You know, why wouldn't you want to get into it? I think, I was trying to think of other industries you might love. I've got a mate who owns a toy company or family.
Oh, that'd be pretty fun.
That'd be pretty good. There aren't too many, you know. It'd be a lot less exciting than if Dad sold insurance. Sorry for any insurance people out there. So born into it, and a lot of people say, well, you know, were you expected to go into it? Was it just, you know, especially when you're in, it was fourth generation for me, and now with our kids starting to make cupcakes and stuff in the deck room, it's fifth. And so you like doing it. I remember, you know, we'd have little primary school bakery tours and stuff, which hopefully we can get back to after, you know, COVID for my kids and their fellow classmates. That was exciting, and seeing all your mates go, God, I can't believe your dad and mum and dad run a bakery business.
Yes.
So it was kind of great. You were proud. You were excited. It was fun. And then my first gig when I was eight was, you know, I got handed a broom and I spent the most part of the next 10 years being in charge of cleaning, which was fine. I remember various times, you know, staff saying, God, you know, you're the boss's son. I can't believe he makes you sweep the floor.
Yes.
And that's really important because I think in a family business, you know, if you're to appreciate all the hard work that went into building the business that I got excited about, it was because my dad grew up sweeping the floor.
Yes.
And his dad grew up sweeping the floor. And to be fair, they worked a lot earlier and longer hours than I do, you know, right now. Mm-hmm. And you hear about people talk about how do you get past the second and the third generation? It's making sure that you appreciate what your parents and your forefathers went through in that, as opposed to some people who are like, I built this so you didn't have to work as hard as I did.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's just rubbish. That's, you know, you're setting people up to fail. So it was that, and so my brother and I, you know, we used to ride our bikes to work from the age of 13 and 14 during school holidays, and appreciated the opportunity to have a job in school holidays, earn pocket money. It was, you know, we got paid as much as your age. So if when I was working when I was 10, I got $10 an hour.
That's all right.
Oh, actually, no, that's what we do now. It was about half that. back in 1985.
I was going to say, you're doing all right.
Yeah, no, it was a lot less. It was a lot less. I went to uni. My brother was the passionate, hands-on sort of pastry cook, and that's why he heads up the manufacturing plant now. Mm-hmm. And he went straight in. Also did really well at school, but he was the hands-on guy. But what we found was, you know, growing up in a true family business, and my dad loves to talk, so dinner table every night was not surprising. All the stuff that he was very excited about at Ferguson Player that, you know, got him pumped during the day, all the things that frustrated him. And so Mike and I had a, you know, semi-degree in Ferguson Player by the time we were 15.
You really understood it.
Mm-hmm. We lived through his experience of the 87 crash and the, you know, the deep despair that, you know, that he and, you know, the whole Australian country went through back then, and then all the, you know, the underemployment and bits and pieces that happened, or the unemployment, I should say. So we got all of that. I went to uni, and I loved uni. I did a commerce degree at Melbourne. But not surprisingly, I still spent, you know, all of my non-uni hours working in the bakery, and everything that I learnt at uni, I found the best way to learn was for me to apply it to the business that I worked in, and all the stuff I'd heard around the dining room table.
Yeah.
And so when I was learning about, you know, marketing or people management, or, you know, spreadsheets were just starting to get into vogue back then, and so I'd never thought about not really working in the business. I did a couple of jobs elsewhere, and our parents always said, look, there are much easier ways to make money than getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning and making cakes and pies. And there are.
Yes.
And our eyes were always open to those things.
Right.
But we just always had a passion for, you know, for this. And we saw, for the most part, Dad came home happy and excited, and there was opportunity. And so I never really thought about doing anything else. But that's because I've got a great relationship with my mum and my dad and my brother.
Yeah.
And baking industry is really fun industry, you know, birthday cakes, pies, you know, other than getting the recipe wrong and having someone throw one at you
and have to redo it.
That's about as bad as it gets, and that doesn't happen too often.
So was doing commerce, if I can stop you, was doing commerce to try and come back in the business and then help it further? Was that the reason why?
It was always sort of, it was a win-win. So either I went to uni and did a degree that I knew that I could help with Ferguson Player, would help me be a better, you know, employee in that business, and there was absolutely no expectation that I would be a manager or general manager or CEO, because at that time the Ferguson family were involved, and there were dual CEOs and dual families, and so it was just, you know, making sure I contributed.
Sure.
But I genuinely wanted to explore if there were other things that happened during uni that got me excited and I could go and work somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
That just never happened. I did, you know, short internship at KPMG or wherever, you know, you go when you're doing some accounting and economics.
Mm-hmm.
And none of that really floated my boat. Just everything that I learnt at uni, I was excited about what could happen at Ferguson Player. Like my dad and my granddad, none of those guys went to uni.
Yes.
They went to, you know, they learnt their trade and they deep, you know, cultural connection to their people, and they've got all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the business at that stage, you know, in the mid-80s, maybe we had 20 stores.
Yeah.
And franchising was coming into vogue and all that kind of stuff. And the business was at a point where it needed to become more sophisticated. And at the very least, I wanted to do some accounting in the business, which I pretty quickly grew bored of. I've realised I've got a creative bent more than a
spreadsheet bent.
If I can combine creative and numbers, I do well. The business does well, but it certainly wasn't export trade numbers and bloody, you know, hedging and.
So did you think that, you know, coming out of that commerce degree was a sort of, because that would have been the early 90s or late?
Early 90s.
So that's when we sort of had, you know, the recession and that kind of stuff, and we saw the explosion of franchising come in, especially with food businesses, and a lot of those food businesses, brands, the franchise brands, actually expand their footprint. Do you think that was just right place, right time for you to come out of uni, commerce degree, want to help the business, and then you've got a Ferguson Player brand which is actually expanding at that time?
Yeah, look, it was, but to be fair, you know, we went from 20 stores to maybe 35, 40 stores.
Yes.
You know, and there's a couple of other really big, I mean, all kinds of food brands went from, 20 or 30 to 200 and 300.
Yes.
And some of them did that really successfully. You know, now we talk about some of that kind of fast growth can happen with a real cost to culture and values and that kind of stuff. But back then, some of them did it really well.
Yeah.
You know, Baker's Delight explained.
Yeah.
You know, you were part of that journey.
Yeah.
The likes of Michelle's Patisserie back pre-RFG days.
Yeah, good point.
Family business, great business, grew well. We're pretty slow, to be honest. And part of that was because the business was comfortable.
Right.
You know, it really was. And I don't know, you know, just call a spade.
Yeah.
We're kind of comfortable and weren't used to fast growth. We had some, you know, the next generation of people running the business weren't that excited about it being, you know, really big, because that brings headaches and it brings...
Yeah.
Stuff that's new and different and change. And to be fair, I was really excited about that, because at the age of 25 or whatever, I was like, let's go, what are we doing? Look at all these brands exploding. We should be there. And the patriarchs of the business were like, oh, well, you know, they're growing too fast and, you know, it's not right for this reason and that reason. And,
right.
And look, you know, that was where we were. Back at that stage. So look, we've got 85 stores now, which is great, but in 120 years, that's pretty slow going compared to plenty of others. You know, I'd like it to be faster and diversified and different. We'll probably get into that a little bit later on.
Yes.
But we don't grow for the sake of growth.
Yes.
And certainly now I think it's harder to do, you know, without messing your business up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's kind of where we're at now.
Yeah.
But
so what about since that time in the 90s, like obviously you're CEO now, like how what other roles have you done within the business in order to sort of get to that point where you've become CEO?
Yeah, so as I said, very early, you know, cleaning, I, you know, worked as a pastry cook, I drove trucks, I did all of that stuff, you know, some of it well, some of it poorly. You know, someone handed me a recipe for 1,000 eclairs, as long as I could follow it, I'd be good.
Oh dear.
My brother's much better at the baking than I am.
Yes.
And he's more excited about it. I was more excited about the numbers. So, you know, mates, you know, during uni days, they'd come and work part-time and we'd head up cleaning for 2 or 3 years. And then after uni, a role came up, our office manager or accountant, you know, needed to leave, and I put my hand up and I was in learning mode. So I started in that role.
Right.
And, you know, it's really, compared to what I was learning at uni, it's flour and water and some rent and some power. It was pretty simple versus all the international trade stuff I've been studying.
Yes.
And that was exciting. And then I was able to get my hands on all of this fantastic information, or using, you know, spreadsheets and some new tech. And having sat around the dinner table and listening to all the things that I know, you know, my father and Ken Ferguson would love to know about the business.
Yeah, right.
Was finally in a position to say, well, we've got all this information. It's just not distilled in a way that allows you to make really good decisions. And so spend the next 5 years, you know, improving our management accounts and what have you, so that we knew where we were going and what we were doing and that kind of stuff. So finance, for a large part up until the early 2000s, and you know, I was really grateful that I was able to take charge of when the franchising code came in in 95, I think.
Yes.
You know, putting all of that stuff together. So I was in charge of all the legals and the relationship building with all that stuff. So the Ferguson family looked after all the franchisees.
Yes.
But in terms of building the foundations at a legal structure and interrogating that, getting through, you know, GST got introduced, all those kind of things.
A lot of change.
That kind of stuff. So I was able to develop some really good relationships with franchisees, but at a head office relationship connection, which stood me in good stead for as we headed into the 2000s. I think it was, you know, maybe 2009. My dad stood back as CEO of the bakery part of the business, and that was my role then.
Yep.
And then in 2012, so between then and 2012, we bought the Ferguson family out, and we went from having two CEOs, one for bakery and one for retail, to the sole CEO role, which I've sat in from then on.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a really good journey.
Yeah.
I mean, it's beneficial that you've done so many different things in the business, so that wherever you are in the business on any given day, you can go, well, I've done that, so I understand it. It may have changed a bit, but usually the fundamentals are the same, right? Like, it gives you a really good credibility with your whole team, I imagine.
It totally does. It does way more so on the production side, because the family predominantly until the early 2000s looked after that and the finance side of things. So when we took control of the business in 2012, you know, we had to reinvent the retail side of the business.
Yeah.
And not the shops or brand necessarily, but the people and the training and the support, and to become best in class around that for franchising.
Mm-hmm.
So it was about getting the right, you know, the classic right people on the bus, in the right seats, all that kind of stuff. And,
yes.
Someone told me it would take, you know, 4 or 5 years, and I sort of I was like, "You're joking? Come on, we'll get 7 or 8."
Both of you are wrong.
Yeah, that's right. So I've not spent, you know, years or decades running stores. So I've had to immerse my or surround myself in people who have.
Yes.
And our retail team are made up of those people who get it. They've either been in franchising or retail, born and bred, you know, from teenage. You know.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about COVID times and last year and how you handled that as a CEO and how you handled that as a brand, because I think obviously you were out in the media a lot last year. You did a really great job in promoting the brand. But as we take this in March, just before Easter happens, right? It's like two bookends. It happened at Easter last year. Now it's, you know, we're sort of coming to some sort of normality now. Like when it first happened last year, what were you thinking for the brand and what kind of moves did you make initially to make sure that your team was fine and they were safe and they could work? And obviously you're dealing in a production facility
here. Mm, mm.
You're producing a food product.
Yeah.
What went through your mind? Like what are the couple of first things you did?
Oh, other than Puma pants, a couple of times before JobKeeper came in and some of those other things. I mean, we had to very quickly move to what's worst case scenario, and like that was pretty bad.
It
was
Mike
and I, you know, we're optimists. That's just the kind of business that we are. But you've got to look really deep about how bad things can get when you're facing into the kind of storm that happened last year, and it was just harrowing. I mean, we have a board. It's a family business, but we have a board, and we try and operate the board as if it wasn't a family fiefdom, that kind of stuff. I've got an independent chair who had been part of Baker's Delight and McDonald's and Choice Hotels and another gentleman on the board who sits on a lot of other boards who, you know, we genuinely believe and know that Ferguson Player Foods will be a better business with the kind of independence and objectivity that comes through board. So
makes a heap of sense.
First of all, we headed into this thing with people who had been around the traps for a long time, which instantly allows you to shoulder, you know, the weight of this kind of stuff better. And you often hear it's lonely at the top. Well, you know, I'm massively grateful that, you know, as much as my brother reports to me, he's still a director and he's an owner and he, you know, we share the emotional journey of this business and have since forever.
Yeah.
So I can share stuff with him that I might not share with other people. And I had a really understanding chair and a board who at any stage, apart from the fact that my dad's still around and I could, you know, he's been through stuff too. So felt well surrounded, well supported, but still had to dive deep and go, crikeys, what's going on?
Yeah.
We very quickly worked out, you know, whatever happened, you know, you measured, it's easy to say you're a good business, you've got good culture and good values when things are good.
Yes.
We thought, first of all, here's our opportunity to really, really demonstrate that, you know, as we go through this, let's be measured by how we perform when we are absolutely pooping our pants back against the wall hard. Now, the theory of that's fine, and I know the reality can be tougher, but we started with let's demonstrate to our employees, to our customers, all that stuff that we are who we've said we've always been, because this is the measure of it.
Yeah.
Secondly, you know, in a lot of our promotional stuff and what have you, we talk about this business is resilient and it's been through, you know, two world wars, you know.
Yeah, true.
A pandemic back in, I don't know, 1913 or whenever the hell that was after World War One, maybe 18.
Yes.
Great Depression, bucket loads of recessions, oil crises, all that kind of stuff. Been through that. Now we talk about that, like, oh, you know, but you know, Mike and I never believed that we would, you know, have our version of having to live through that thing. And we're like, part of it was like, all right, batter up.
It's game on, boys.
That's right. You know, whoever's running the business in 20 years can chalk this little, we survived COVID, hopefully. And here was our chance. You know, we thought, give our great grandfather. You know, when he came over in the early 1900s, you know, was German, opened in Mooney Ponds, Puckle Street, and survived World War One and all the stuff that comes with World War One and World War Two and being German and and not Australian and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he can survive that and we can survive depression, we will get through this.
Yes.
And so that first of all was just sort of fortifying ourselves around predecessors had done it.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to give this everything that we've got.
Yep.
Secondly, got a great team. I mean, in the last 10 years, we've never had a better group of people working for the business.
Yeah.
You know, they're tough. You'd be in the trenches with them every day of the week, and the trenches got deep. So we were like, all right, again, time to batter up. And really, you know, no one blinked around that stuff. But we did have to, like lots of businesses, soon as sales started to come down, and in the worst of it for us, 40% down.
Wow.
And across 80 stores, that was a mix of 90% down and 90% up.
You know, right.
Depending on where, yeah, depending where they location. Were during that mm-hmm. crisis. Mm-hmm. So had some diversity of geography that really helped there.
Yes.
But we had to move to percentage of salary positions and what have you, and the team were very understanding of that. But I'll sort of fast forward through that first lockdown in COVID where, you know, and JobKeeper came in. They did the right thing. The government, I think, moved quickly. And regardless of criticisms of whether it was too much, yep. too little, all that stuff,
yep.
they heard on the side of generosity, and I think it helped us be less anxious about things. Mm-hmm. The banks also, with freezing loans, that kind of stuff, gave us some freedom. Landlords, I'm not going to talk about. For the most part, some of you out there listening, you were great. Most of you were pretty ordinary. But moving on. But we got through that kind of stuff. And after the first lockdown, we had done better than we had predicted we could have done. We went from 40% down up to, you know, back up to sort of comping. We still were eligible for JobKeeper. But, you know, come by the end of September, we found our way out. But after that first lockdown, we as much as we'd gone backwards and we'd lost money and things like that, we could afford to repay all of the salary that we had deducted from our executive team, apart from about 3 weeks that were just scorched earth kind of things.
Yeah.
And this was part of that, demonstrate sort of who you are, and who knows if we're going to have to get everyone to take a salary cut again in 6 months because it's COVID, right?
Exactly.
So, you know, and that involved me, the chairman, and anyone who got paid. Everyone came back at that percentage. Mm-hmm. And so we repaid that, and that was a proud moment, and the team were really grateful, and it was just part of us trying to do the right thing. Second lockdown happened, you know, longer, worse, but based on the first experience, we're like, let's just keep everyone pumping. We need them, you know, they're kind of all emotional support for franchisees more than any of the other things that they did, and helping, you know, have our franchisees hold the line. So, look, none of our stores permanently closed. The longest anyone was shut was for a week, and that was just because mental overload.
Yep.
We ran the store for them while they were off because we're like, let's just keep this going so you don't lose your customers. and so if you look at all of that, just, you know, really grateful for having got that done. Now, it's still been tough. It's nowhere near as profitable a year as we would normally forecast and budget out.
Yes.
But if you take profit not just as numbers but maybe some, I don't know, a demonstration and some authenticity that we are who we say we are, you know, I'm hoping our behaviour will be bankable in the next couple of years for people who want to join a business that supports them, or franchisees who felt supported. And that's come up in some of the surveys that we do. We do a biennial survey with 10,000 feet. We had our best ever net promoter score with franchisees. It was a wonderful validation of the support we gave them. Now, they still had a massively hard time.
Yes.
But through the various things that our business support managers did, our retail team, and some of the head office stuff doing silly videos and just trying to keep them happy, was really well received.
Did it affect things like supply chain and those kind of things as well? Because we're talking about a brand which is solely in Victoria, which had a lockdown for over 100 days, that produces a product for franchise partners.
Right at the start, it was tough. You know, when there was a big run on supermarkets and meat.
Pies.
We spent a couple of weeks wondering if we were going to be able to make pies, sausage rolls, pasties, which is a large part of our business.
Because the production of that also slowed.
Absolutely. So, yeah, exactly. Everyone got cut back to percentage and you had the cedar meats thing, which, you know, made, you know, meat works and what have you even. Mm-hmm. Even more top of mind for government and controls.
Mm.
So we were able to, we quickly jumped on our meat suppliers, and, you know, we're not huge compared to the really, really big, you know, meat clients out there.
Sure.
But we were able to keep enough going through. But in the middle of all this, we did, you know, I reached out to other pie suppliers, and as much as they're sort of semi-competitors, we've got some relationships with other bakeries, for disaster plan type relationships, because if they go, we'll help them. If we go, they'll help us.
Yes.
And so I reached out to a couple and said, look, you know, God forbid we can't make any pies. If you've got supply chain, you know, would we buy yours for a while?
Right.
And they said yes, but for the most part, you know, Coles and Woolies and everyone else are buying them, and I'm not sure if I've got any left. So it was... We did a lot. We had a couple of nods, and we didn't have to test that. So we didn't run out of meat. The run on supermarkets, you know, sort of stopped. We're able to, you know, get those kind of things. Not much other supply became an issue, other than if we needed to bring in bits of kit from overseas. We were waiting on some ovens and some things like that. That everything just paused, of course, in Europe. And you know, we had spent a lot of work around. Well, what would happen if we had an infection in our facility?
Yeah.
Biggest risk. I mean, then I'd absolutely have to buy, you know, get things from elsewhere. So, you know, we've had just the most stringent controls here, you know, routine separation, temperature checks like you saw when you came in.
We
had
really good
both doors. No one's allowed downstairs from upstairs, all that kind of
stuff.
So that if someone came through and the team who made all the cupcakes, if there was an infection there, then that wouldn't necessarily
affect the whole bakery.
Exactly. Now, we didn't have to test that, and that's not always a given with the DHHS. But we worked very, very hard to make sure that happened. So as soon as this stuff locked down, temperature checking, thermal scanning, all that kind of stuff, so we can record and move on. But for the most part, no, everything else we were able to get. Part of being a vertically integrated business and making everything ourselves is that, you know, we are the main supplier for all of our franchisees.
Yeah.
From the party pie to the wedding cake. Not that there were many wedding cakes during COVID. Actually, to be fair, we you know, part of being able to look back and now realise why Ferguson Plaire did well through world wars, depressions and recessions is that we sell a lot of stuff that people really still need during those lockdowns. They're still time poor. They're still busy trying to survive. So a pie or a pasty with a bit of salad, you know, or a little pick-me-up in the middle of a really depressed day like a chocolate eclair or a vanilla slice was still a good go-to for people, and we were allowed to trade. You know, part of the
your essential service. Yeah,
part of that really nervous moment up front and watching New Zealand lock down even bakeries was, wow, are we going to be like shut fully?
Yes.
And, you know, thank goodness we were allowed to do takeaway. And we had substantial, you know, range of products that are available for takeaway. Mm-hmm. So caveat to that was celebration cakes, of course, which went for, you know, I mean, like 80% down overnight.
Yeah.
And we quickly pivoted to, you know, people who might have had a party for 25 people. Clearly only had 4 people in the house. So we, within a week, launched a little party range of cakes, just, you know, 20-centimetre diameter cakes that have just gone off. And they continue to go off because, you know, we sort of stumbled into a place where not everyone wants the big $200, you know, cake, and they just want to just be able to rock up and not have to order it because everyone's running late on birthdays and those kind of things lately.
Yeah, 100%. I was going to say, like, at the start of this, when this happened, Steve, I said to a lot of, like, close friends of mine, I said, the real brands are going to show.
Yeah,
during this time, the ones that have proper brands, the ones that really care about, either, for example, like with yourself, like franchise partners and support office team, or the ones that really care about their customers, which is obviously where the long tail of this goes for Ferguson Plaire, are really going to show through, right? And it's obvious that, you know, you guys are doing a fantastic job in Victoria and really growing even more credibility and respect, you know, at nearly 120 years. Like, what kind of things are you looking forward to for the brand that you've seen during COVID that you want to now move forward on? Like, there's obviously changes in the food sector that have happened. Yep. We've seen some collateral damage. We'll probably see more in 2021, unfortunately. Yeah. But what are you looking forward for your brand now, the Ferguson Plaire brand, that you have stabilised the foundation and you're ready to go?
Yeah. Yeah, I think just getting excited about the new normal. Everyone says new normal, right? But genuinely knowing, you know, what's the new foundation for retail, for our business, that kind of stuff. You know, everyone's been tested and made it through and getting out the other side. There's always a version of a party that you want to have happen. So it's working out, you know, where is that and when can we go really hard?
Interesting.
I think what COVID's done in lots of ways is, you know, if you had strategic plans and ideas about what the future might have held, you know, it's like massively compressed everyone to think about that stuff and work out what's important and what's not important. And so I think there's some real clarity around the things that you are working on. You've made it through COVID. They're still the right things to work on. Well, then on the other side of it, you double down.
Yes.
Is what what we will be doing and what I'm hearing lots of other businesses who are able to do that is, you know, do twice as much of the things that you thought were right in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Drop the things that weren't working and are just rats and mice kind of projects.
Sure.
And then there's some pivotal stuff around, you know, retailing and where it happens. You know, the online stuff. I mean, everyone's talking about it, but it's some really nice analogies back to when China went through SARS in the early 2000s, and when Alibaba exploded onto the scene and everyone was forced to bring their businesses online to survive SARS, and we sort of really weren't exposed to that in Australia so much. But when SARS disappeared, the online penetration in China stayed there and it went up. And I thought, well, that just happened globally. It's ridiculous to think that any of that's really going to fall away anything like at a meaningful level.
Yes.
So we had luckily before COVID started working on a new website, just a streamlined, better design, device agnostic kind of thing. Launched that in the middle of COVID. That's been great. Sales are up 120% in the middle of COVID.
Wow.
We turned on delivery in the middle of that, and like lots of other businesses who weren't on Uber Eats and Deliveroo, and that all got turned on, and that's become a thing, which is great. So we continue to work through that and invest in that. Delivery online, but optimising website and that channel, and being really wary of the large shopping centres. I mean, we've absolutely dialed up our focus on strip locations, suburban centres, that kind of stuff. Larger shopping centres, sure, there's a place for that for us, but at a particular rent per square metre and not a dollar above. Some businesses that just got absolutely pillaged at the end of that, and I understand some of the big shopping centres are owned by, investors, and they've got to get a return and all that kind of stuff, but there's some very deep thinking about that whole omni-channel thing and how much a shopping centre contributes to your online sales and how much it really free rides on your online sales. Mm-hmm. And so, there's absolutely a place for that. But us thinking about how that all works is really important. And I think there'll be lots of businesses going, why wouldn't I be building a pure play online version of my business?
Yes.
Where I don't need the bricks bit. I've got some other bits that do have the bricks bits and that kind of stuff. So that's one of the things. And for the last couple of years, we've been very digitally focused at a customer-facing level. Got a couple of cool things in pipeline that help just improve the overall experience, especially with making complex processes either internally or at a retail level, less complex for the humans, right? Computers are great at taking those things and then spitting out a nice simple solution. So we've got things like celebration cakes that are very complex ordering processes for customers. I want blue icing, three tiers, this flavour.
Yeah, can good you do point. This?
Here's a picture from Instagram. I want my daughter wants that exactly.
Yes.
And that requires a lot of human interaction, and we can digitize that to a certain extent. So that's something we're working on, which is really cool.
Awesome.
And then internally, I've got 200 different products that get ordered 7 days a week, delivered fresh. And across 85 stores doing that 7 days a week. I mean, there's a lot of zeros on the number of orders that come through the facility. And we have the capacity for to improve the way that we do that using computers. Now, we already do that. We've got lots of online ordering systems and bits and pieces. We've got some predictive ordering tools coming and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, cool.
And they're scalable. We're at 85, but look, we might be in other states at some stage. We might have different versions of the business, but they can all use the infrastructure that we're building with some of these digital tools.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the other thing is, food trends. Yeah, lots of people spend lots of time, for those people who weren't able to work or had to work at home and couldn't get out and exercise as much as they like, they'll scanning the nutritional panel. 10 times more than they were. Everyone's got their COVID waistline that they're dealing with, and we sell cakes and pies.
Yes.
For the most part. We're the treat end of that. And so people know about those kind of things. They have forever, but I think that's accelerated. And there's a real opportunity, for all food businesses to look more deeply into that. And, we launched our vegan range of meat pie, meat sausage roll products. Mm-hmm. And Ferguson Player customers are not typically target market for that.
Sure.
But so we thought this would be a slow boil. We gave ourselves 3 years to get to a certain percentage of our sales being the vegan products. It happened in 2 months.
Wow.
Just with it's a great vegan pie. And I should say that because I went vegan for a year and I'm now, almost vegan. Any vegans out there will just be like, think I'm disgusting for saying that. There's no such thing. Vegan. I'm flexitarian. Okay. it's the plant-based revolution it's a triple win. For everything. It is a win for the animals, and if that's your passion, that's it's a win for the planet because it is absolutely carbon and water less intensive, unbelievably, and it's a win for your body.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, totally some people agree. Would dispute that, you know, but I've been like this. I mean, I'm going to the gym. I haven't lost weight. I've got, oh, sorry. I kind of haven't lost weight. You can get, you can gain weight being vegan. You know, but I haven't lost muscle. I'm healthy.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. And people are making those choices. And for us at Ferguson Player or in some of the other channels we'll develop, it's about giving people choice.
Yes.
And what I'm seeing with my kids and my team's kids is there's an awareness, a much bigger awareness than anyone who's, you know, sort of over the age of 25 or 30 about, you know, the impact of, you know, protein from animals for the planet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if you put all of that aside, you know, it is fact that unless we have some major disaster, there will be 9 billion people on this planet in 2050 and they cannot get all of their protein from animals. So let's just get with it, regardless of all your moral stances.
Let's just understand it.
Let's get good at it because I love, you know, I grew up eating meat pies. I love a good meat pie and a good sausage roll.
Me too.
But if at 2050 it's like caviar, I still want to eat something, you know, that tastes like that.
Yeah.
And I can with something that's just as high in protein, just as high in iron. You know, it's still a treat.
Yes.
You know, it's not half the fat or a quarter of the fat. It's not far off, you know, normal pies or burgers and all the other meat replacements out there.
Sure.
But it allows you to know that, you know, the impact of what you're consuming is less. And that extends to things like low sugar, no sugar.
Yes.
There's the whole salt thing, you know, that's been on the charts. And I think better for you products, not necessarily good for you, but better for you products are certainly worth focusing on. And then during COVID, we also launched gluten-free pie, soon to have sausage roll, and there'll be a range of other products out there. And again, for many years, celiacs and gluten intolerant customers would come and we'd say, look, it's not something we're really good at, so why don't you go to this supplier and that supplier?
Yep.
We actually had a list of people we would point them towards because we wanted to help them out.
Sure.
But, you know, but clearly, and again, any celiacs or gluten intolerant people will be listening going, oh, yeah, well, sort of no shit, Sherlock. Absolutely, we're a bit late to the party, but we do make a cracking gluten-free pie and a whole bunch of other great gluten-free things that are going to be coming forward. But look, that's not new. That's been in all the sort of, you know, futurist reports for the last 5 or 10 years, and it's just made me realise that, you know, as soon as you see some of these things tick up 2 or 3 times in a row per year, you just got to get on with them. And everyone hears this, be willing to make some mistakes, place some bets, win or lose, double down, move forward, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I think sometimes it's okay to be late to the party, you know, not to attend, right?
Yeah.
So that's really interesting. I want to just ask about the vegan range because you've obviously said you had a three year outlook and then you've done it in 2 months.
Yes,
is that because you've changed changed people in the experience into going into the shop and going in? They would have bought a normal meat pie and they've gone, oh, you've got a vegan pie. Like, I'm wanting to move to that, or are they coming in as new customers to Ferguson Player? Do you have any sort of anecdotal or data on that?
It's only anecdotal, but I think, you know, when we were developing this, we saw this as a real opportunity to grow new customers because if you're vegan or predominantly vegan, you're probably not coming to Ferguson Player other than for some cool flour, vegan cakes. You know,
sure.
It's a lot easier to do sweet vegan than savory vegan.
100%.
So we thought, look, a large portion of those customers will be new. It's a great business strategy.
Yes.
Secondly, you know, Ferg, you talked about some of our sustainability creds and what have you. You know, a large part of our journey has been around, how do we make this stuff with a lower impact on the planet? And I'm fourth generation. My kids are fifth generation. We care about the next 120 years. You know, it really annoys me when, you know, you've got capital timeframes that are 4 and 5 years.
Yes.
That doesn't fix the planet.
No.
It's not going to sort my kids out when, you know, they're not able to live the way that you and I live now, or we lived when we were growing up.
Yep.
If Ferguson Player or Player Foods can help people, you know, really happily migrate from a meat product to every now and then a plant-based product that tastes just as good or close enough.
Yes.
That's amazing. I mean, the environmental impact of a standard meat pie versus our vegan meat pie is very different.
Yeah.
And we will continue to make amazing meat pies and sausage rolls and pasties. It's for the customers to make the choice. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a bakery dictatorship here. It is, you know, making lots of products for lots of different people so that they can have choice.
Yeah.
That is, I think we've increasingly got people who are maybe inquisitive about those types of products. And, you know, for a year in development before we launched that, you know, I was the person who said, look, I've been eating at Barge for a long time.
Yes.
Make me a pie that makes me really happy on a Friday night when I'm watching TV and I'm drinking a beer. Now, yes. That's the experience that I want. If we get that right, you know, there's a good chance we're going to sell some. And some people just want that beautiful comfort food experience of a pie. Lots of people, with the research we've done, you know, pies are not the product that they were 10 or 15 years ago for lots of different reasons. But you know, the research shows that people would love to eat more pies. Yep. They might eat one a month right now. Yep. They'd love to eat two a month.
Yes.
But the research shows, just give me a reason. Don't give me the same pie.
Yes.
You know, make it delicious gluten-free, or make it delicious vegan, or give me some unique, delicious flavour or experience.
Yep.
That is better than what I've grown up, because in my mind I've migrated to other stuff, and there is so much delicious choice out there.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've got two more questions before we wrap up today, Steve.
Cool.
The first one is, what have you learnt about yourself as a leader during this time, during the last 12 months?
Yeah, that, I mean, I think everyone in this business will say they, you know, more resilient than... You always hope, you know, when
you always
things
hope
happen,
you
always hope you're tough, right?
Yes.
Like you just go, oh, man, I'd bullet a gate, I'd just push through. But, you know, it must be, it's not like that, but, you know, if you're in a war and you have a gun pointed at you for the first time, well, you pretty quickly work out really what you're made of. And, you know, we had an economic equivalent of that happen in Australia.
Yeah.
And, I had some, you know, some sleeplessy nights, but... What I found that if you surround yourself with the right people, you can get through anything. And look, my chairman, was, you know, he had a term where we'd talk about the team. He'd say, look, out of all of your team, you know, and this is well before COVID, you know, if I told you can only take 2 of 10, who would be in the trenches with you? Who would you take with you, you know, to stare down the enemy?
Right.
And that's all you had. And it's just a great way to look at things.
Yeah, it's just a great way to focus, isn't it, really?
Exactly right. Mm. And so, you know, luckily for me and for us, all of the people in our team during COVID were those people.
Yes.
And we were those people for them, which certainly I think stands us in pretty good stead for what we do moving forward and for more challenges.
Yes.
I, you know, found out that our team and the business has the capacity to live the values that we've had on our walls for a long time. And that's really nice, because you go from that sort of, I don't know, tacit, yeah, of course we're like that,
yes,
to, you know, no, we're putting that on a T-shirt and we're wearing it for the next 5 years, because, you know, maybe not a tattoo. But, you know, you know, this is absolutely how we live. We've been tested, and we're going to keep living it this way, because we got through with all of that stuff. And resilience, you know, from that first discussion where Mike and I were like, all right, far out, all the forefathers went through their things, we're going to get through our thing, and look, you know, God forbid, we're not through COVID yet.
Yes.
But when or if the next lockdown happens, or when or if the next pandemic hits, you know, we know what we've got to take, we know we've got what it takes to get through that.
Yeah.
We moved. I mean, I haven't talked about, you know, we obviously had to move very quickly to, when you're 40% down, to you know, bring your costs down.
Yes.
We had to, you know, move deliveries, cut off certain products. You know, beg forgiveness in the middle of all of that, when we got franchisees who said, "Look, I can sell this," but like, yeah, but we can't make it. It's
you know,
all those kinds of things, and we moved unbelievably quickly and autonomously. You know, the bakery knew what they needed to do very quickly.
Yep.
The retail team knew what they needed to do. They, you know, on a daily basis would come to me and say, look, you know, this is what's happening, this is what I need to do.
Right.
Not this is what's happening, what do I need
what
to do?
What do I do? Yeah.
You know, because, and that was great, because I just would have melted.
Too many decisions. Melted.
People just got it done. They got it done, which is really good. So, a massive, you know, testament to the team. Did a great job.
My final question on the podcast, as it is with everyone I interview, Steve, is what are you looking forward to both professionally and personally in 2021?
Yeah, I think out of all the stuff that I've just talked about that I think we did quite well, is it also highlights what's the stuff you need to do better moving forward. So, you know, every year I try and engage in a major personal development thing of some kind.
Okay.
And so a couple of the team have said, you know, how about, you know, someone in the business get really skilled up around disaster management? little bit, you know.
Did we just do that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, so we did it well without education. Imagine how good it would be if we have a proper framework for that. So I'm like,
love it.
Awesome. We don't all have to do it. Cause, you know, but if someone goes and does that and sort of reverse educates the team, that would be a great place to be.
Yeah.
And strategy and future thinking. You know, so we've always been – we've just finished a – excuse me. That was my chairman calling. he said – he must have been listening. He said strategy. Well done. That's exactly what we're trying to work on. is, you know, futures thinking and just, you know, everyone having the chance to navel gaze during COVID, during those times where you couldn't be where you wanted to be.
Yes.
And trying to predict what does it look like on the other side of this. I just think, you know, continuing to be as good as possible at identifying trends and the ones that are bankable moving forward, because whatever happens, you know, the whole world's just gone through this massive acceleration of everything.
Yes.
You know, from online to, you know, cultural stuff, value stuff. We've got the stuff going on in Parliament, human diversity, all those kind of things, food trends, sustainability. I mean, everything is just being compressed. And so I think your capacity to make the right decisions quickly is really, really key. And for us, as much as inside Fergus and Claire we had diversity, we had stores that did really well and stores that did less well because of the lockdown, is it became really clear, you know, during that I'm like, oh, gee, I really wish we had a business channel or a sales channel in this area because that was, you know, more resilient.
Yes.
And, you know, that thing that we've been thinking about over there, gee, you know, it'd be great to have that the next time there's a whatever it is, recession, depression, you know. So diversification has been on the cards for the business for quite a long time.
Okay.
And we will accelerate that into certain channels. Only strategically aligned type stuff, but I've got a facility that makes some wonderful products, you know, for a large range of Fergus and Claire stores.
Yes.
But we've got the capacity to do that into some other channels. I'm not talking about competing channels, but, you know, whether it's a pie or a vanilla slice or it could be export one day.
Yeah.
All of those things. Sure. We just, you know, we've just got to go hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about yourself personally? What are you looking forward to this year?
You know what? I mean, I spent lots of time with my kids last year. Some of it doing silly TikTok videos and bits and pieces, which was really good. But I think I did a sort of a measure of that at the end of the year. We'd done like 50 or 60. I've never done a video clip in my life, right? I mean, my wife dusted off her media tour. She did a media degree and she's like, that's ridiculous. You've just done that on your iPhone. Like, why don't we just get Adobe Premiere and you've got a green screen at work that we just happened to have behind this other screen we had. That's how that all happened, right?
Wow, okay.
And that was a lot of fun. And I like being creative and I've got a bit of a musical background. But I'm genuinely looking forward to pouring that creativity into, you know, strategy and business excitement.
Yeah.
And that's the stuff that I get out of bed for, you know, some of those things that I've talked about around whether it's digital innovation, diversification. It really is that. You know, yes, holidays, all the usual stuff, you know, just holidaying outside of, you know, my suburb or, you know. That kind of stuff. But I'm really grateful that with kids at the age of 5 and 8, you know, they're around a lot.
Yeah,
there's a lot of homeschooling. I'm really going to enjoy that not having to happen again, fingers crossed, COVID. So I think that and just getting on with it. I mean, when you're in a family business, it is, you know, lots of people have work life and home life and it's very integrated when you're in a family business.
Yeah.
And you know, I love it. I mean, I really, really love it.
Yeah. It just shows. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.
Steve, a lot of people are going to listen to this podcast and want to engage with you or understand more about the brand. I know you guys are really focusing on doing more stores in Victoria this year and maybe changing over some sites to Fergus and Claire. Like, how can people find out more about the brands?
Yeah, look, it's the usual stuff on website. There's a lot of really good information on the Fergus and Claire website.
It's an awesome website.
Cheers. The team have done a great job this year getting great it right. Easy to find the information. And I would just say to anyone looking at for a franchise or for a business, just do your research because the wrong franchise will just wreck you.
Yeah,
and the 100%. Right franchise will just have you so happy. And Fergus & Claire is right for some people and it's not right for other people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, our team are fantastic at answering those questions. And when we, you know, run it through our facility, everyone, you know, I get to meet everyone and vice versa. And I'll talk as honestly as I am to you right now, you know. So, 100%. Website for sure.
Cool. Steve Blair, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Sean. Good on you, mate.
Thanks again for tuning in to another episode of Principle of Hospitality, the podcast. We hope you really enjoyed this episode. Please comment, like, and share this podcast with your friends in the industry. We're making this content with the industry in mind, so we'd really appreciate you sharing along with those that you care about in the industry. Thanks as well to our sponsor, Chef's Hat, the largest family-owned and operated hospitality supplier in Australia. They strive to inspire cooks, chefs, bakers, and bartenders to deliver the best product with the best tools every day. We're so proud to partner with them. That's where the industry shops. And if you don't know us at Poe, Sash, my co-founder from Principal Design, has one of the best design agencies in Australia. So if you're looking for anything around strategy, branding, digital design, and graphic design, then you can find them at principaldesign.com.au and myself at Open Pantry Consulting for anything to do with hospitality operations, strategy, and recruitment. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thanks to Chef's Hat for supporting us. And until next time, stay safe. Cheers.